Barbara, with courtesy appointments in film and media studies, comparative literature, and global studies. Her primary interests, research interests lie at the intersection of digital media and humanist inquiry, with a particular emphasis on cultural critique, artistic practices, and language, which includes code work, machine translation, electronic literature, and electronic English. Her book, Tactical Media, A Study of New Media Art in Relation to Neoliberal Globalization, has been published by the University of Minnesota Press in its Electronic Mediation series, and her most recent publications include the co-edited Electronic Literature Collection Volume 2, as well as articles on poetic and narratological uses of mobile and locative media and text-based media arts installations. In the English department at UCSB, she currently directs the Transcription Center and co-directs the Literature and Culture of Information specialization. She has had fellowship appointments at the National Humanities Center and UCLA, and part of the Mellon-funded project on the digital humanities, and she's taught at Rice University and the University of Minnesota. Her talk today is titled Textual Practice, and please join me in welcoming Rita Raley.
So thanks very much, Kimberly. I appreciate all the work you've done to organize this, and thanks to Jim as well, and really thanks to the whole Mellon Digital Humanities Group. And thanks to all of you for coming out in week 9. You seem a lot more alive than I feel. I guess it's good to see. Okay, so I have been, as Kimberly says, working on artistic uses of mobile media lately. And the core premise of my remarks today is that texting is actually interesting. In other words, rather than thinking about a kind of strict work-play dichotomy whereby what you do with your pen or what you do with Microsoft Word is intellectually serious and rigorous and what you do with your mobile device is just for fun, I want, in a sense, to complicate that and look very seriously at what I'm thinking or regarding as one of the more important scenes of reading and writing. So I'm talking about texting for public display. Okay. So, are text messages displayed on large video screens or mobile variable message signs, text messages projected on building facades, or on open ground in public squares? Are these messages meaningful or not meaningful? And what is the structural form or logic of these scenes of reading and writing that would command critical attention? Would a laudatory or a skeptical tone predominate in an analysis of an SMS art installation, the expressive heights of which at times run the gamut from "you are gorgeous" to "this wall is way more popular than me"? Were one to focus on linguistic content alone and regard each line or set of lines as poetic utterance with the proper reading method that implies, most likely we should feel skeptical. But to drill down into the substance of any one particular text would be to occlude all of the moving parts of each installation. And I'm going to be talking about a number of different installations and projects. But the moving parts include hardware, software, display surface, the audience, of course, physical environment, telecommunications infrastructure, and all of the social and technological protocols that govern the production and reception of the projected messages. The urge to read, to do more than receive or process, is not so easily disregarded. But the transitory aspect of the messages means that subjectivity constituted in relation to the text must be screenic rather than literary. The exact temporal structure of each art project, each installation, differs. But what they necessarily share is the evental form. They're live, they're continually refreshed, they're said to run for a set number of days or hours per day, and the messages on display are thus impermanent. What one reads with a momentary glance walking through the square or down the street, as in this case, is likely not to return. And while the moment of textual consumption might be captured and replayed through recorded documentation, it cannot be restaged or reenacted. So these public art installations that I'm discussing are interactive. Both remote and on-site participants are invited to contribute a text message of their own to the data feed. They're cited. They can't but engage the specificities of each place, and by extension, prompt a consideration of what is public and what is private. And they're social. Participants are continually negotiating their relationship to the audience, to the crowd, and to the readerly communities that are themselves continually mutating. So for example, in Matlock and Yok De Jong's Speaker's Corner, participants contributed text to the live feed on a 15-meter LED display that was wrapped around the corner of a media building in Huddersfield, shouting, so to speak, by text message through a web interface or by voice message from a phone booth. The title of the work, Speaker's Corner, invokes the ritual performance of public speech as civic participation. And in this sense, its eventual fate was entirely fitting. The screen was hacked, the external booth was vandalized, and a library of expletives was accrued after the contributions had to be filtered in response to municipal complaints. What was at stake then was less the physical parts of the work than a negotiation of control over property, over technological systems, and public speech. A similar experiment with civic dialogue was performed by Johan Gee in a work called Hello, Mr. President, and this was at Davos in 2001. It was a mountainside laser projection of text messages sent to the ostensibly singular addressee, then President Bush, during the World Economic Forum. The extant discourse on text messaging for open display is remarkably thorough in its concern with issues of urban and public space, participation, and community formation. Of particular note are the series of urban screens conferences that were held in Amsterdam in 2005, and Manchester in 2007, and Melbourne in 2008, and a number of related publications, among them the Urban Screens Reader, which was published by the Institute of Network Cultures. But these installations or events have not yet been considered, as I think they ought to be, as scenes of reading and writing that are particular to our moment of ubiquitous mobile media and that make visible certain transformations that are occurring in our relationship to text in the ordinary sense of linguistic signs. So the premise of my analysis is that understanding what's happening in these new scenes of reading and writing, that is to say, the fundamental components of textual practice, or the rhetoric of interactive text projection, or interactive text events, can help us more fully to understand the dynamics of ephemerality, vernacularity, and distraction that are at the heart of the way we read and write now. Erki Huhtamo, who's down the road at UCLA, Erki Huhtamo has for some time made a persuasive case for the development of what he calls an archaeology of the screen, which would focus not only as screens as designed artifacts, but also on their uses, their intermedial relations with other cultural forms, and on the discourses that have enveloped them in different times and different places. The artifactual and genealogical work he does toward this end is richly narrated, extending well beyond what we might call a mechanistic or positivist sense of the screen to account not only for shadow theater, for example, and modes of visual storytelling that lack a traditional technological apparatus, but also for the social rituals, discursive conventions, and bodily habits that they've engendered. So my argument is that comparable work needs to be done with expressive uses of mobile and locative media, or writing beyond the screen, so as to articulate them in terms of practice while still heeding the concrete specificities of the individual works. And here the broader context is to think about the work that's been done in media archaeology, the practice or the field of media archaeology, which so often turns around an investigation of materiality and temporality, but doesn't always allow for an investigation of social relations. So the big question is, if you open the black box and all you discovered was something, or the black box told you something about social relations but not about materiality or the artifact, the question is, would it still be media archaeology? And the other part of this puzzle is to think about the work that Lisa Gittleman has been doing on the, which she calls the socially realized structures of communication at the heart of media. So our post-medium condition necessitates this analytical move because we now clearly confront a variety of expressive experiences and activities that are not formalizable as electronic literature. We confront, in other words, expanded fields of reading and writing that are not electronic literature, not codex, not telephony, not game, not conversation, not collaborative content creation, but that which is situated in the interstitial field. Expanded reading and writing, following from what Rosalind Krauss says about sculpture in the expanded field, expanded reading and writing, the cumulative effect of that which is not, is admittedly an abstraction, even as it maintains a tenuous, flexible link to the material substrate out of which it emerges. It's an abstraction, but it's a productive one, because it allows us to think across media, across platforms, genres, and modes, and to articulate a discourse on digital textual practices that are mobile, social, and live. So I read texting for public display as a practice following Nigel Thrift, for whom practices are to be understood as material bodies of work or styles that have gained enough stability over time through, for example, the establishment of corporeal routines and specialized devices to reproduce themselves. So practices unfold within a structure of bodily habit, a set of physical activities that, while modular, nonetheless cohere when ordered by a procedural script. The script is necessarily repeatable, and it's the repetition that allows a practice to emerge as a practice. So practice, its etymology drawing from the French fit for action and the Greek to experience, negotiate, or perform, is that which is experiential and enacted in the moment, but it follows in the wake of what has been, retracing routinized activities that have been performed in the past, and it's necessarily oriented toward the reenactment of these routinized activities in the future. So the actors within these scripts are not only humans, but encompass the whole of the object world, and specifically the material presence of specialized devices that are neither inert nor simply used. As Bruno Latour and others have made clear, the world is a complex mixture of discrete actors, human and non-human, with each actor mediating and thereby transforming the other. Devices then play a necessary role in the digital textual practices I'm outlining, but the installation or the event or the performance spaces as a whole are concrete assemblages of these devices, but also bodies, screens, signs, architectural structures, and barricades in the form of walls and fences that govern the movement of traffic. In other words, these practices are neither reducible to these artifacts and apparatuses, nor are they explicable as after effect or consequence, as in the notion that the activities that unfold are simply the result of a script that's been programmed and put into play. Rather, practices are themselves generative. Again, they reproduce themselves. They're not products, but processes, always embedded within human and non-human networks of relation that are themselves constituted through performative acts. So, for the digital humanities, also for, I think, the humanities in general, these types of textual practices can present certain challenges precisely because there's no stable object to recover and preserve for future study. Certainly, the individual events can be documented with photography, with video, with narrative description. The hardware and software that's used can be preserved and/or emulated. And eyewitness and accounts and explanatory statements by the artists can be critically explored. And indeed, it's worth noting that my reading is entirely dependent on all of these archival techniques. It wouldn't be possible for it to be otherwise. The displayed messages are also incidentally archived, though it's worth noting that archiving is a byproduct of the technology rather than part of the structural logic of the work. But these practices are importantly live, again, enacted and decoded in the moment, and participants aspire to be part of that moment, to contribute to the events as they unfold, rather than to be part of a permanent record. These moments occur within the context of a singular project, but the practice itself is reiterative. It functions within a certain material structure that's shareable and translatable to different contexts, and it's that structure that's available to critical scrutiny. Okay, so now some more concrete descriptions of some works. And then I will come back and make more general statements about how I think we can understand them. So there are multiple genealogies for SMS artworks for public space, almost all of which originate with this project, the Chaos Computer Club's Blinken Lights, which was an interactive work that invited participants to engage with and to contribute content to a pixelated display. The screen was formed out of a lighting system that was installed in the top 8 floors of a building in Berlin's Alexanderplatz. So this work is often discussed again as a sort of point of origin, a point of origin. Less discussed are, as precursors, are two works that primarily used web interfaces for remote participation. Clickscape, which was a work of clickable public space, as the artist put it, that had projections on two buildings on either side of the Danube and Linz. And a second, around the same time, the internet tunnel, which was installed in a tunnel in The Hague. But the projects out of which my thinking on textual practice fully emerged involved participation on a much larger scale, either in terms of sheer numbers of messages, duration, or geographic reach. So the first, Urban Diary, was a screen-based installation on the platform of the Alexanderplatz underground station, and over the course of its 3-month run, it garnered approximately 10,000 entries. I'll come back to that one. The second is Paul Nutzold's Textual Healing Series, and this is a series that's been performed with a laptop and a mobile projector in cities such as Brooklyn and Baltimore, San Francisco, but also Munich, Beijing, Rotterdam, Bucharest, and so forth. I'm also going to come back to this one. And then the third primary example is called City Speak, and this is from OVX Lab at Concordia University. And this has been installed about 20 times in cities throughout North America. So a comprehensive catalog of SMS artworks for public space is well beyond the scope of my remarks today, but a schematic overview will outline the distinctive aspects, or again, the rhetoric of textual practice, which encompasses a range of handhelds, and it's not limited to a particular hardware architecture. Input devices may vary, and certainly for many of these projects, multiple platforms are enabled to allow for audience contributions, kiosks, for example, or voice messaging systems. While I recognize the importance of the recent proliferation of scholarship on the material specificities of hardware and software, an expansive and transmedial concept of public messaging allows me to articulate textual practice as such and identify its relatively stable and repeatable components. Works that have been installed and performed in different times and places might share the same structure, but it's important to note that they wouldn't have the same content in the sense that external forces would shape each event differently. Thus, there can be individual motivations, teleology, and characteristics like volatility and unpredictability, all of which that would result in different manifestations of a reiterable practice. Okay, so back to Urban Diary. So Urban Diary, which was from the New Society for Fine Arts, played with the relations between private and public by inviting the text-based submission of diary entries, true to the title, Urban Diary, inviting the submission of diary entries that were then anonymously displayed after a 24-hour interval, the temporal lag between reception and projection allowing the author to become part of the audience and preventing direct address in the sense of hailing. The only explanatory information in the station, this was installed again in the platform of a metro or a T station, the only explanatory information was a web address and a telephone number that would be present on the fade out of individual messages. The effect of that withholding, there weren't wall labels or there weren't any flyers in circulation explaining what people were looking at, the effect of that withholding was to create a sense of secrecy. The knowledge of the project thus transmitted through the same popular word of mouth channels that circulate rumors and gossip and flag the cool. Making visible the voices of the crowd and turning the station platform into a space that one inhabits rather than simply moves through was a specific intervention into public space, but it wasn't tinged with nostalgia for a mythical public sphere. Rather, it was an attempt, as the artist said, to design and install interfaces between streams of technical information on the one hand and perceptible urban spaces on the other. In other words, to construct a new public space, one that would be situated in between the actual and the physical on the one hand and the virtual on the other. Its overarching purpose, however, was more provocative. It was to give place to replace or relocate existing communicative potentialities within urban space. So instead of a melancholic lament for what has been lost, it was an affirmative gesture, an invitation to its audience to exploit the potentiality within the communicative field. In other words, to produce something new. So what matters is not the substance of any one message on display, powerful as it may be to provide the infrastructure for the articulation or the expression of political and economic frustration, like, I just wanted to say that ever since the Euro, I'm paying more for practically everything, but I'm not earning any more. So again, what matters is not the substance of any one message. What matters is, in fact, the infrastructure, which extends well beyond hardware and software to include the conditions of possibility for the actualization of those potentialities, the communicative potentialities of which the artists speak. Urban Diary is in this sense, as the artists assert, a reclamation, a winning back of life itself. More modest, in terms of both the technology and the philosophical commitments, was Paul Nutzold's staging of his textual healing series. Using a building facade as a projection screen and writing spaces that were demarcated with speech bubbles or geometric shapes, Nutzold essentially set up temporary shop on street corners, and he would distribute his mobile number to passersby, soliciting messages that were displayed automatically, anonymously, and in real time. So unlike the Urban Diary installation, for which the messages were scanned and those that violated extant privacy laws intercepted, the messages sent during the textual healing events were not filtered. What results then is a mishmash of babble, general commentary of interpersonal dialogue, and anonymous self-articulation. Utterances in the form of I am, I like, I love, that allow a participant to establish a certain relationship to herself and to risk self-exposure in exchange for affirmation for others. The fleeting affective component of the various utterances are reminiscent of the sentiment analysis visualizations such as we feel fine, and also twist story, in that the projected text messages capture a mood by presenting the murmurs of the crowd. Sentiment analysis, you've probably seen these, just called, this one calls from Twitter, phrases beginning with, as you say, as you see, I love, I hate, I think, I believe, I feel, I wish. The projected messages also seem to represent the idle mutterings of ourselves to ourselves, as was noted about another Twitter visualization, London Wall, which was an exercise in distant reading of local social media posts. However, textual healing, along with the other interactive installations of the sort that I'm describing here, are crucially different in that they're instances of distributed writing and synchronous communication rather than data collection. Moreover, the modality of textual practice is not collective and aggregate, but rather disparate individuals acting and speaking in common, a mass of subjective articulations that masquerades as collective consciousness. Not we feel fine then, but rather my loneliness is killing me. If texting itself has a black box structure in the sense that one is not customarily privy to the output, texting for public display reconnects that circuit between input and output, making the writing space visible and allowing participants to ping a channel, any channel, hello world, seeking ordinary response or self-affirming feedback, or sometimes simply in order to make some noise. The virtuosity then is that of the common speaker rather than the technically proficient or conceptually sophisticated performance artist. For, as Paolo Virno reminds us, the fundamental mode of virtuosity, the experience which is the base of the concept, is the activity of the speaker. And this is not the activity of a knowledgeable and erudite locutor, but of any locutor. For Virno, it's precisely the vacancy and the transitory nature of what he terms idle talk that makes it generative. Because it's not anchored in philosophical and historical or emotional substance, it can function as a free-floating site of discursive invention. As he notes, idle talk resembles background noise, insignificant in and of itself, yet it offers a sketch from which significant variances, unusual modulations, and sudden articulations can be derived. Background noise is a zone of potentiality, a site that may give rise to creativity and invention. Communicative activities, then, do not reflect, but they rather produce the state of things. The utter ordinariness of most of the messages on display, "I would like a hot chocolate," is thus entirely the point. Expertise in this sense is shifted from the professional and granted to the ordinary speaker, whose idle talk might be insignificant, but for this reason has the potential to generate something new. And this is the third project. This is City Speak, and this is just a screen capture of an installation they did in the Victory Park complex in Dallas. Victory Park is the largest system of LED screens in North America. So one thing to note about the work that they do in particular is to think about the engagement with their environment, often these commercial spaces. So what they often do is think about repurposing spaces that have been traditionally given over to advertising, appropriating them the space of consumption for purposes of composition. In this respect, they transform both the form and the function of the large screen video displays from commercial broadcasting to participatory circuits that include the public. So monologic advertisements are instead become bulletin boards and chat spaces. Scott McGuire suggests more generally that tactical interventions into commercial spaces provide a striking comparison to manufactured media events, where the media simultaneously desires spontaneity as a way of attracting an audience, but generally occludes the spontaneous by imposing standardized frames in order to minimize the risk that nothing happens. Interactive text projection is necessarily spontaneous rather than rehearsed, because one cannot predict what information will be input. Even with content filters in place, such a multi-contributor project is a literal instance of crowd composition, of crowdsourcing. This in and of itself is not new, but something emerges in the process of City Speak that is performatively, operatively different from text with a single input channel. The streaming of multiple messages makes stabilizing a singular voice impossible. The collective quality announced in the visual and verbal density of the palimpsestic displays of text. And the signature of the individual author or artist then becomes displaced onto the design of the installation itself, particularly the construction of the site and the algorithms that manage the text display and the structures of participation. Michael Giesecke articulates the historical context for the prioritizing of multiple communication channels operating in real time. In his account, as mass communication, with its minimizing of participation, gives way to a culture of interactivity, feedback, and recursivity, we see a deep sociocultural, literary, and aesthetic investment in face-to-face communication as the situation of maximal interactivity and multimediality. Once media breaks from the print market model and develops to the point of synchronic feedback between production and reception, the issue of synchronization between communicators, or interactive channels, necessarily emerges at the fore. So if one follows the logic here, text-based interactive installations would be the paradigmatic instance of media communication in our present moment. They're a rich investigative site both for me and for the artists from and through which to explore the fundamental experiential transformations that have occurred in our reading and writing practices. So that, what then, again, are the implications for the digital humanities, the humanities more generally, or even literary studies, of a textual practice that's about transient display and process rather than the artifact? How do we understand the significance of events that are, in a sense, pure process, pure performance, or pure participation? Objects of analysis that disappear rather than endure. In what sense, if at all, does their ephemerality push the parameters of a discourse on comparative textual media to a kind of limit? So embedded within the installation sites is the potential to generate immediacy, a sense of being in the moment, a real time that's an enactment rather than a destruction of the present. So contra Paul Virilio, for whom the technologies of real time, quote, kill present time by isolating it from its presence here and now for the sake of another communicative space that's no longer composed of our concrete presence in the world, but rather of a discrete telepresence whose enigma remains forever intact. An interactive text performance does not displace present time from itself. Rather, the event itself is composed in the moment of performance. It's not, in this sense, a replay. So to pursue this line of thinking further, contrast the potential to generate immediacy, a sense of being in the moment, with our cultural obsession with storage and archiving, which is perfectly illustrated by Chris Mendoza's Every Word I Saved. This was every word the artist saved to his hard drive in a 6-year period from 2000 to 2006. He harvested words from his text documents, from email messages, from IMs, and then alphabetized everything. The original capitalization was retained, but otherwise all the content or context was stripped away. Even a poetics of radical mimesis, such as Kenneth Goldsmith's uncreative retyping of the September 1st, 2000 edition of the New York Times word for word in his work Day, even this does archival work, all claims to function as a monument to the ephemeral notwithstanding. And consider again the London Wall installation, which culls publicly available status updates from social networking sites, the data from which has been preserved as an instantaneous social history or a museum of ordinary London in poster form. With a text event, as John Cayley says in an entirely different context, the process is the text. So text events are communication circuits, feedback as opposed to the data separation inherent in the archive. The display surface may be a writing surface, but we're not looking at a scene of inscription or a graphic techne, but rather chance juxtapositions, the play of dialogue and conversation. So compare an interactive text installation with a work by Jenny Holzer. With a Holzer, you have a singular input for a speech act manifesting as linguistic spectacle. And with a text installation, rather, you have multiple inputs that produce an interactive and an ephemeral conversation. The basic units of analysis, then, are durational. How long does the text hover in the foreground? How long does the audience remain in place? How long is the work installed? While texting for public display may be considered as ephemeral graffiti in general terms, graffiti is a highly skilled practice that at once articulates and consolidates identificatory group formations. The bar for participating in text events, on the other hand, is quite low. No particularly specialized literacy or skill is required. Everyone has an invitation to participate, and no communicative device is more widely available. Indeed, at this point, there are many text-to-screen systems available for commercial use, and it's colloquially said that every first-year media student worth her salt makes a project in this vein. In other words, an interactive and a social work that makes prominent use of text messaging. As with flash mobs, too, the cultural consciousness of text events far exceeds the actual participants. So it's possible to claim that they're commonly accessible, even if they're not commonly in the sense of actually experienced. So along the same lines, SMS-based media arts artist projections might seem specialized in terms of generation, Generation M or the texting generation, specialized in terms of habit or socio-technical milieu, and a first-time reader or viewer might initially be non-comprehending, overwhelmed or bemused in her search for meaningful signifiers, or at least uncertain about how to construct a meaningful lexical structure around the display. So here it's helpful to refer to Roger Chartier's recent argument that form is linked to both the mode and the experience of reading, as in the case of encyclopedias, the reading of which, he says, is segmented, fragmented, discontinuous. Much the same could be said about reading projected text messages, but absent the first-hand knowledge of sender and receiver, they also crucially lack a discursive context, indexicality, and also the kind of navigational menus that cross-referencing can provide. So reading projected text messages in the midst of a crowd is thus distracted reading. Sequentiality exists only insofar as there's an actual spatio-temporal connection between fragments or messages, and there's no governing frame that would bring them into order either retrospectively or in real time. So too, there's no single focal point for the audience's attention. Erica Robles has persuasively argued that a shared screen doesn't necessarily correlate with shared information, and that co-orienting toward a single source is dependent upon the alignment of the context, the single screen, and the mode of address, the articulation of a common audience. Even were a message to fulfill those conditions, it would only be momentary, fading into the background or disappearing entirely. So the interruption of an attempted focused reading can also, of course, be achieved by ordinary environmental factors, such as noise and obstructed views. All of the different displays are intended to be to some degree legible, but semiotic certainty can only ever be partial, and sustained attentive reading practice practically improbable. But it does not need to be this way. That is, we could be, or we are even now, being inaugurated into different practices of reading and writing, such that large urban screens are becoming quotidian. Our distracted reading is thus only such in relation to the conventional symbolic structures that we're conditioning ourselves to move beyond. So Erki Hutamo, again, surveys the screening landscape in Los Angeles, and he identifies all of the LED billboards as what he calls a new medium. But we could say they're really only new in relation to prior screen technologies. In other words, they're no longer new in the sense of newly encountered. Put another way, they're losing, or they have lost, what some might call the gee-whizzery effect, with the result that they're not even noticed in the same way. In other words, large-scale displays, or video displays in general, while on the one hand directing attention, are also ambient, foregrounds that function as a kind of background. Ambient, but not necessarily in the sense of managing behavior and attention. Responses by the audience, acknowledgement of the receipt of messages, recognition of repeated or threaded messages, even the communication of boredom, suggests a certain conditioning to want more stimulus. The varied responses remind us that these messages are processed, they're received, they're interpreted, and they're thus modified. It follows, then, that modes of engagement are both conscious and apperceptive. Semiotic structures that are so manifest as to be interpreted without the reader or viewer ever becoming self-conscious about that interpretation. As Johanna Drucker says about language in the landscape, as we observe words in the landscape, they charge and activate the environment, sometimes undermining, sometimes reinforcing our perceptions. Interactive text events invite collective attention, but not in a pernicious fashion, in the sense of propagandistic manipulation. The group or collective audience is held together by the transmission of affect. The unity is to be understood as functional, as operational. As Nicholas Barreau says of relational aesthetics, that which substitutes intersubjectivity or the experience of being together for the private symbolic space of art. The audience concept must not be mythicized. The idea of a unified mass has more to do with the fascist aesthetic than with these momentary experiences, where everyone has to hang on to his or her identity. It's a matter of a predefined coding and restricted to a contract, and not a matter of social binding hardening around totems of identity. Neither is it a matter of binding participants to the regime of the screen. The contract rather specifies a momentary experience and an immediacy that has both a temporal and a spatial dimension. It's about what happens in a particular place at a particular moment. So individual subject and collective are linked by processes of exchange. An inner life might be projected to an abstract audience, thus making it collective. And another's affect, the affect of the crowd or gathering, might become one's own. It's going to get worse. The coalescence of a crowd and the mobilization of affects are temporary then, though nonetheless inextricably linked, as Teresa Brennan explains in her account of how a gathering is constituted in part through the transmission of energetic affects, which may add up to something more than the individual affects of the group's members. Relationality, then, is enacted rather than harnessed or captured, which is all the more meaningful in a socio-technological milieu that is in no small measure dependent on the manufacturing and regulation of mutuality. The micro-communities that emerge from the anonymized mass or crowd are contingent, the occupation of physical space temporary, the negotiation of relations to that space and to others fluid, dynamic, and emergent. They are then counter-publics, which for Michael Warner are spaces of circulation in which it's hoped that the poesis of scene-making will be transformative, not replicative merely. Counter-publics, idle talk, background noise, these are all fields of energy, the transformative potential of which remains to be exploited. To hope that they will be exploited is to speculate. To communicate, to enact rather than transmit, is to speculate affirmatively, to open up a space for creativity, experimentation, and invention. The significance of textual practice, I think, is precisely this, to provide the ground for ephemeral idle talk, the communicative flotsam and jetsam out of which something new might emerge. So what is the relation, finally, between a cultural imaginary of the humanities as pragmatically structured by an archival impulse on the one hand, and these text events as an instance of ephemeral performance on the other? Perhaps we might consider the extent to which the humanities might be further legitimated on the basis of our work to consider, produce, and critique the making of meaning that may not necessarily be preserved. In other words, at least one part of the work in the humanities is to understand both the meaning and the presence of objects even as they flicker and leave. In short, to understand artifacts that go away. Perhaps then we have a vested interest not only in forms of monumentality, archives, and canons, but also in maintaining a continuous connection to ephemeral production, to take account of, even ironically to preserve in some form, that which would otherwise disappear. We also ought to have a vested interest in taking account of things as they happen in real time, but a real time, a present time, that's not isolated from its presence here and now, but one that nonetheless allows for critical reflection. So, I'm so over audience participation. No, let's talk it out face to face, it's complex. Thank you.
So we'll open it up to questions.
I really like how you mentioned distracted readings because it made me think about how we're influenced by our distractions.
Mm-hmm.
And since the primary theme within your work is understanding what is happening with interactive text events,
mm-hmm.
it does make me consider or question how does society get influenced by these digital displays,
mm-hmm.
and especially when we're in commercial settings.
Right.
How do you feel that we're being influenced by that.
Right, no, absolutely. And so, of course, a lot of work is done on the way that screens mobilize our attention. Advertising certainly functions in these terms. And you can think about the history of the use of large displays of any sort, whether video-based or not, for propagandistic manipulation, mobilizing the affects of the crowd, the investments of a crowd, certainly. What I find interesting about these works is that they attempt to sort of intervene or short-circuit in that kind of capture of our attention. But paradoxically, they do so by introducing not a counter-capture, but a kind of distraction. So there's a way in which distraction functions as a kind of countering mechanism. And in that sense, we don't need to worry about it and think about distraction as something that needs to be tamed, brought into focus. In other words, all of the worry about how we're distracted readers, we're getting stupid because of Google and Wikipedia, we can't pay attention, is of course, you know, all about industrial capitalism wanting us to pay proper attention and sit up straight in our chairs. So in that sense, I'm thinking that distraction is something that we ought to embrace and reclaim, precisely because you can think about it as, again, short-circuiting or interrupting this kind of command or capture of our attention.
One more thing.
Yeah.
So then, would you say that it's that government approaches more the subconscious
mm-hmm.
of the individual?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, sorry, I missed it.
Does it have to do more with the subconscious of an individual when we're talking about interactive text?
Well, what interests me is both the sort of conscious modes of perception and the apperceptive modes of apprehension. In other words, that which is sort of below or beneath the threshold of our awareness. This goes back to Benjamin and what he has to say about the work of art, that the public is an examiner but an absent-minded one, he says, meaning, you know, distraction is, again, a way of paying attention. Distraction, not the term he uses, but the term we would use now.
I was interested, I noticed that a lot of your examples were from Western Europe,
mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of curious if these movements are originating there or if we see them in other parts of the world, and if we see them happening in English or in other languages?
Yes, so Paul Nutzold definitely did an installation in Beijing, and that would have been multilingual. But you can imagine that I think he actually did it around the time of the Olympics, so he's going to have a more cosmopolitan audience necessarily, of course, too, based on where he chose in the city. In other words, the traffic is going to determine the language that's used in part. But it is very much true that a lot of these works are emerging from media arts collectives or institutions, primarily in Germany and the Netherlands, but also the UK, and that just has to do with the history of media arts practice more generally. A lot of these works have been also installed or performed in Brazil, which is in a way the new capital of media. I mean, that's a generalization, but that seems to be where a lot of the energy is going. A lot of the investment, both ideological and affective investment and financial investment in media arts, is sort of moving to Brazil in interesting ways. So yes, very much we're looking at a kind of contained circulation. And I show you English language translations of some of the ones in German, but of course they would have been in German, a lot of them were in German over the course of the 3-month period. But because of the way documentation works, they have to be in English so that they can reach a global audience. So you're right, they're absolutely situated or culturally specific on the one hand, but on the other, you can sort of track ways in which they do sort of move around. Of course, you're always going to be looking at the same kinds of circuits in which the mobile devices themselves move. Yeah?
I do have one more question. So it is based on media archaeology. You mentioned something about how certain works or styles have gained enough stability over time. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? Or, I might have just noted it wrong. Based on media archaeology, can you just elaborate more detail?
So the works gaining stability over time, that would be the Nigel Thrift line about how practices function. The connection in media archaeology wasn't directly from the Nigel Thrift exactly. It is in the sense that the work is both sort of implicitly and explicitly positioned in dialogue with, but in a critical dialogue with platform studies, with software studies, with that whole tendency toward the artifact, the critical look at the artifact, which again I think is hugely important. But it's often the case that kind of media archaeological work is not invested in technologies in use. It's much more interested in matter, temporality as well, but matter. So my interest in bringing Nigel Thrift into the conversation is to think about that part of things. Again, technologies in use or the social.
I'm curious about the question of writing and writing practices.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm all about disruption and new things and all of this, but I'm noticing that this writing is super banal.
Yeah.
And in many cases, it's kind of performative.
Right.
In a super banal way.
Yes.
And so what, I don't know, maybe you can just talk about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, my ongoing joke is that the subtitle for this is In Defense of Banality. I mean, again, I think it's the ordinariness of it that interests me. And it's less the sort of ordinariness of the individual message than the ordinariness of the whole communicative field. Okay, so there's a lot to be said here. So the other sort of trend or movement I'm kind of working against is the move toward institutionalizing digital textual practices as part of the history of avant-garde writing practices. So this, I think, is of course not the way in which we understand writing with digital media at all on a sort of everyday basis. And it's certainly the case that there are really interesting practices that are part of this tradition, and John Cayley would be one, and there are numerous others. But it strikes me that we would do well to pay attention to where our students and where we ourselves are actually doing our reading and writing. And that involves looking, again, at a field more than a particular utterance. So the ordinariness of a particular utterance is, as I said, sort of precisely the point, because you're waiting, this is thinking, you're waiting for something that would be not banal to emerge.
Yeah. Maybe that's the new thing that potentially could be.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you're right, it does have that, a lot of it is just about pinging a channel, trying to see if you can get a response from someone else or having a dialogue with yourself. But that in and of itself, I think, is more interesting.
Say a little bit more about your sense of the virtuosity that's at stake here.
Right.
So in the Verno, if I'm remembering correctly, he mentions Hannah Arendt and this notion of, I think, publicity and public performance, perhaps. And then he also mentions or develops that notion of virtuosity with regards to Glenn Gould and Glenn Gould's move in away from live performance into totally mediated musical.
Right.
Composition, performance,
right.
And exhibition. And I'm always curious as to, you know, my interests have to do with musicality and media and rhythm. I'm always curious as to sort of what remains of this kind of musical aspects of virtuosity that Verno alludes to slightly, not to romanticize it. Because Gould is a great example of someone who took advantage of the tools of distraction.
Right.
But I wonder what you think of, if you have any observations about the temporality or the rhythmic nature of the events that unfold around these displays.
Right. So it would be different or specific to every circumstance and every moment of every particular work. But the move that I think Verno is making there away from Glenn Gould is perhaps a move away from musicality or a kind of suppression of musicality. I don't know how overtly we want to regard the turn away, but I do think it's important because it's a shift away from the technical proficiency, the sophistication, to the ordinary. So Glenn Gould then comes to embody or emblematize precisely that virtuosity in what we might regard as its ordinary sense.
Yeah, I mean the background noise aspect of virtue of this event,
yeah,
I think, is important.
Right.
But I mean, even that could have a musicality. But I guess I'm really asking about like the pacing of participation.
Right.
Whether there's ever an interchange between two textures that might be sustained.
Sure, for some of them, yeah.
Because it seems to me that this is really kind of the antithesis of like hooking up on some kind of online site for texting.
Yeah.
Where there's like the event, the ideal desired fantasy event would be people getting together individually as kind of these atomic individuals.
Right.
Whereas in this case, you have this kind of, in a way, the text, as you were pointing out, is sort of non-events in and of themselves.
Right.
But it's rather the fact that nothing is happening in the text, per se, but something is happening in the environment.
Right,
and
right.
You know, it's that sort of distraction that echoes back as attention to where you are.
Yeah.
And I wonder about the temporal aspects of that.
I mean, this is where, in a way, my analysis always falters in a sense, because it would be so different for Urban Diary, where there's the 24-hour lag between production and reception. Deliberately so there couldn't be that kind of hail or direct address.
Right.
And they were worried about privacy. I think they were actually under some sort of civic restriction there that sort of limited what they could do with the space. So it's difficult to generalize when I have that type of work and then Nutsholz, which is in real time, and you do, there was often, or obviously there are many performances I don't have live experience of all of them, but nonetheless, you could have that kind of liveness. So you're right, there is a temporality, the pace, the rhythm. These are all things that one would need to attend to in the way that one would have to attend to attend to them in a particular performance. So a performance studies scholar would certainly wonder how it is that I don't regard each event or installation in its fullness, or you know, in the complete sense. Obviously, I'm suppressing in order to abstract out. But you're right, I am losing this focus on the temporality, or I displace it into thinking more in terms of process.
I think it's really useful, this emphasis you're putting on process.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that you mentioned that had this 24-hour delay, I think that's really incredibly important that it's not all live. And we appreciate the process is actually not just maybe larger than what we are getting to participate in.
I
think this is back to your point about the power of distraction. There's a lot of work going on in terms of affect that if it doesn't recoup those things that we can't really participate in, at least it sort of shifts our attention to the larger context of the event.
Yes, I do think, and for that reason I think it is much more sophisticated than the kind of guerrilla work of textual healing, but the guerrilla aspect of that has its place.
What do you think also, I forget the name of this, I think it's like live space animation, or not real time animation, but it's when they do a time lapse. I've seen videos of this done in Brazil. Well, they do a live graffiti across like a whole urban site, and sort of the camera will sort of follow it in time lapse. And so it only really, you only ever see this graffiti movie develop over this film, over this building.
Is it writing?
Over time, well, it's all kinds of, it's graffiti, so it includes writing as well as figuration. But that only exists as the archive.
Right.
I was just wondering if you had, if you were aware of that, because it seemed like an interesting counterpoint to the kinds of things you're getting at here.
Yeah, no, I don't know this. So is it multiple contributors that are working on this? Or
it has to be some kind of collaboration, because there's a graffiti artist and someone doing a time-lapse video capture of this massive expanse of urban space being painted, like, you know, an entire side of a building or a corner or around the corner.
Sure.
And so the camera is on time-lapse and they're moving the angle as well. So, but it's this notion of it almost like the event of graffiti that only exists as a film archive.
Right. Okay, so that's part of the okay. What's the name of it again?
I'll have to look it up and get back to you. I can't remember.
Were people alerted to be on the scene when it was happening, or was it? more about the record that then was circulated.
I think it tended to be more about the record that circulated,
frankly.
That is
fascinating, okay.
But if you were there, you'd notice that
right.
graffiti that wasn't there before.
Right, right.
So.
So thank you very much for this very interesting work. I'm a big fan of tactical media. And one of the questions that I have, I've been meaning to ask you, the Occupy movement, this sort of boots on the ground return to street protests, started to manifest after tactical media. And here we get another manifestation of people wanting to occupy space or using technology to occupy space. I just wanted to get your take on the Occupy movement more generally.
Yeah, so, you know, I actually do have a couple other talks that are related to the tactical media book that I could have given today, and they're maybe a little more entertaining, and in that sense, I'm wondering if I made a bad decision. But one of them does begin with a discussion of the Occupy movement in part, and what interests me in this, of course, I can only talk about this at a very general level, but what interests me about it is the eschewing or the refusal of a teleology, that, in other words, what the Occupy movement is often faulted for or indicted for is not having an end game. And Jody Dean has been one of the more vocal voices in this regard, but there have been many others saying that if it's not linked to any concrete political program with a set of goals and an end objective, then it can never manifest in anything like meaningful structural transformation or meaningful change. But I think the conversation, the public discourse has already shifted. So if one is looking for a tangible, concrete result, I think it's clearly before our eyes, and in the way that the mainstream media, and I know that's just a meaningless generalization, but the conversation has definitely shifted, and in that sense, I think it's done important work. We could talk. Are you going to dinner? We could talk more about the Occupy movement.
I'll actually I just really like that. I'm also big fan of tactical media, but I like shift here in this project into this kind of hybridity of the hardware and software, and how that's a necessary aspect of the production that's taking place. And I also wanted to connect that to Dr. Tobias's talk about physicality. There seems to be like an effective sampling going on here that makes me very much think of. I actually really enjoyed the banality of it because I think that works in contrast with the place where that banality is coming from and the connection of it into creating this new bricolage, meaning that, I don't know, I just think that's interesting. I was wondering if you had anything to say about either that or about the importance of like the combination of hardware and software to working with this as opposed to
I mean, the first thing to note or to acknowledge is that I certainly do orchestrate. I have a playlist of the individual messages, and it does have kind of a musical component, but it's more in the sense of a playlist in the sense of ordered formative utterances. I'm still musing on the musical part of things. But anyway, so sorry, I was thinking about that and lost the
I just was wondering if you could speak more to that, especially in relation to tactical media, which is very much not about the hardware, where that's, you know, not only the hardware, but the physicality of this as a performance. Some of my own work is about, you know, shifting from the software to the hardware because there's more agency there. Because it's more immediate.
Sure.
Right, and it's less controlled than we're
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, in tactical media, I was interested in works that were multi-platform, multi-sided, multimodal, and so forth. And in a sense, that interest carries through to this and some of the other work that I'm doing now, in that I don't tend to focus on a particular architecture, information architecture. And the performance element is certainly continuous in that it's there in the tactical media book and here as well. If there's a turn at all, it's actually a turn with respect to virtuosity, because in tactical media I was interested in thinking about the work that programmers do as a mode and a process that we might regard as sophisticated political intervention. And here, I'm less interested in virtuosity in that sense, but more in the sort of Virno sense of the everyday, of the idol, or the background. And in that move, I think one can also see a shift, not away, but certainly in the direction of thinking more in terms of affirmative work rather than the kind of melancholic negativity of critique. So the playful part of things, I think, is something that I'm more strongly focusing on now.
I became interested when you mentioned Brazil and
mm-hmm.
capital media.
Mm-hmm.
Does the sense of setting within location decipher what gets displayed? As far as that goes.
So sorry, can you say
does the sense of the setting decipher like what's going to get displayed? As far as capital media, or can you elaborate details onto that?
In terms of
industrial capitalism.
So certainly the setting determines the content in the sense of, let's take City Speak. So in Victory Park, there's a certain audience that's going to come through in order to go to the theaters there or to the big box, not big box stores, but the big chain stores and so forth. So there's a way in which you can sort of anticipate output, but not fully, because you never really, there's no concrete or necessary link between a demographic and a particular speech act. But certainly the setting, like a bar setting or an art gallery, sets up certain parameters because there are protocols involved. There are certain things you can say at a bar that you wouldn't say in an art gallery, even though we sort of imagine that these are transgressible spaces. Nonetheless, there are these sort of social protocols that are governing what can be said or what isn't said. Especially with a small group, when there's a possibility of being identified, because City Speak is more or less real time too, so one would be careful in this, because you'd be cognizant of the fact that the 20 other people in the room would know that you had just said something, like speaker's corner.
Thank you.
Yeah?
At one point in your talk, I think when we were discussing this textual healing work,
uh-huh.
you kind of made this gesture towards the text event as a form of, as a type of speech act or some like connection to the speech act. And I guess I just wondered if you could elaborate on that.
Yes. So did I say
you kind of mentioned this text event and then shifted into a quote about speech acts. So I guess it's just maybe in the juxtaposition of what you were saying that maybe this connection happened in my brain that
right,
didn't happen
right.
for real.
Right, right.
But nonetheless, I wondered if possibly there was any connection.
Well, the connection would be, again, to focusing on synchronous, let's just call it synchronous communication more generally. So those you would think of, and that type of communication or communication circuit you would think of in terms of acts or processes rather than thinking about a particular utterance. So again, I'm interested more in the processual part of things rather than the product.
Please join me in once again thanking Peter.
Thank you.